Welcome to the MedTech Talk podcast. This is your host, Jeff Cardo, and I'm very excited to welcome Bernie Appy as our guest on this edition. Bernie is someone I've known for over 15 years, and he's had an illustrious career working for and with many of the household names in the MedTech universe. Companies like Summit Technologies, Intralase, EB3, Wright Medical, among many others. Bernie's written a new book called Cutting Through, which details the management system that he and his colleagues at Summit developed and subsequently refined. This high-performance management system is now the framework that many of the leading companies in our industry use today. Bernie, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Jeff, thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure as well.
Well, terrific. So, you know, a place we're going to talk about a lot of things, but a place I often like to start these podcasts is really your little bit of your background and your entry into the MedTech ecosystem. And what I find particularly interesting, you know, given your role where you're really advising companies today, is that you really started as a teacher in physics and then moved into business. And tell us about that. Tell us what about your role as a teacher, and you've kind of come full circle, but also how you got into the MedTech universe.
Thanks, Jeff. As you pointed out, I started life after college as a physics teacher. As an undergrad, I was largely pre-med. I also studied geology and physics. And those were kind of my first loves, the physical sciences. And then after a couple of years of teaching, I decided to go to business school. It was kind of a few different options there. But in the end, I was attracted by the two-year timeline and interested in moving forward with my career. But I was also committed to maintaining my connection to science-based technologies and approaches. And that's, I think, how I ended up in the medtech industry after business school.
And how big a transition was that going from teaching kids to, working in medtech?
It was a pretty big one, and I wouldn't have been able to affect that change if I hadn't spent a couple of years learning business, right? And so that made the transition a lot easier from teaching and academics into business. But one thing I was committed to when I left my teaching role was someday going back and teaching some more. I found that role to be so rewarding that I knew I wanted to come back to it. And of course, by the time I came back to it, I wasn't qualified to teach physics anymore, and just replaced physics with management science.
No, that's great. Well, after teaching high school kids, you can probably handle any client out there. So, well, good. Well, your experience, transitioning into business and then specifically at Summit seemed to set the stage for what you've done with the high performance management system. So maybe starting with Summit, tell us the situation you encountered there. And I know you were very influenced by the people you worked with at Summit, but give us the lay of the land, because this really was one of the seminal technologies in ophthalmology. Yet there were some real issues, right?
Yes, there were. Yeah. Well, Summit was founded in 1985 in Watertown, Mass. The initial funding came from Boston Scientific, and the initial indication was cardiovascular, to use excimer ablation within the coronary arteries to remove plaque and restore blood flow. The ophthalmic application came later when some scientists realized that you could ablate cornea tissue and change the shape of the eyeball. Summit pursued that aggressively and was the first company to receive FDA approval for excimer ablation of cornea in 1996. After that, however, they lost their way. The company went into competition with its customers because they didn't feel the customers were smart enough at marketing the procedure. Company got in some unrelated businesses in contact lens. And by the time I joined in 97, it was kind of a mess. We had disappointed shareholders, demotivated employees, and even angry customers based on how the founding team had performed with those customers.
And so tell us, you know, given that set of circumstances, and I think this is probably where Dick Palermo and Bob Palmisano also, you intersect with them, but tell us how you went about turning around the company.
Well, the credit goes to Bob Palmisano, our CEO. I think the first thing that Bob did was change out the team. With the exception of R&D, he brought in an entirely new senior executive team, new CFO. I was brought in to head sales and marketing, new head of operations, new head of clinical regulatory, new general counsel. And so, you know, that was kind of step one, was changing the guard, bringing in folks that, I guess in our case, we didn't know what wasn't possible. And, we believed in the technology, and we believed in the direction that Bob, wanted to take the company. In fact, that's why I joined the company. It was, I was on the West Coast with a company called Mentor, probably familiar with them. And I was running sales and marketing for their ophthalmic division. Mm-hmm. And things were pretty good there. You know, it wasn't a broken company at all. But I was attracted by the challenge of helping Bob turn Summit around, and the rewards that, would come from that kind of a transformation.
And this was now you're really the first exposure you had to, you know, what you call now the high performance management system. But tell me about that. And I believe, you know, really Dick Palermo was kind of the architect of at least simplifying it and putting it forward in a context that was really digestible by these types of companies.
Absolutely. Yeah, we wouldn't be here today talking about the high performance management system if it weren't for Dick Palermo. Dick was number two at Xerox, chief marketing officer in the late 80s, early 90s, when Xerox was under significant pressure from Japanese competitors who were selling copiers for less than what Xerox could make one for. The Japanese copiers were more reliable and they were easier to use. And so David Kearns, who was the CEO of Xerox at the time, turned to Dick and said, benchmark the Japanese, find out how they're able to achieve these levels of quality at those levels of cost, and help me transform Xerox into a very different company. And so Dick's benchmarking with the Japanese took him through the Toyota production system, took him to the DNA behind that and Edwards Deming and Joseph Juran. And from all of that, he developed an early version of a management system that would provide a more competitive footing for Xerox especially given the new threat from Japan. And so that was the sort of the birthplace. Dick retired from Xerox in the mid 90s, and then we became at Summit. We became one of his first clients, and so in that way, we were learning together and constantly iterating and continually improving the system that he had used at Xerox.
And so I think it would be helpful to to give the listeners an overview of what this is. I mean, some of the things that fascinated me about it, and you really explain it well in the book, is, you know, you're almost using like the principles that we take or normally associate with quality management and extrapolating them to how you would manage the overall business. Tell us more about what this system is and entails. And it truly is a system, right? It's not the individual activities. So tell us more about it.
Yeah. It's a system, which means that it's more than a process. It's more than one process, and those processes connect into a system. And so for me, you know, when Dick Palermo presented this to our senior leadership team in December 1997 at an offsite in Orlando, Florida, I just developed a sort of a visceral or gut reaction to the content. To first of all, its simplicity. It's leverage of quality practices and principles such as the Pareto principle to provide focus. Being closed loop, all of that really appealed to me. I think probably appealed to my scientific background as much as it did my business background. Dick said in that room that we were going to reduce our priorities to four or five vital few initiatives. And then we're going to put them on one page, and we're going to align the whole organization to those priorities. And that, where appropriate, we would use structured problem solving to work our way through those priorities, and then have a kind of a cadence of leadership support of those initiatives. That was very different than kind of what I had experienced previously. Leadership was more about inspection and results, and I would sort of classify myself up to that point as a pretty good results manager, you know, say, here's the target, go hit it, however you have to hit it, right? And so Dick's approach, the simplicity of Dick's approach, the closed loop nature of Dick's approach really appealed to me. But I was surprised to learn in the hallway, you know, at that first break, that 80% of the executives thought it was too simple. They thought it was, you know, hokey, and that, you know, we had 20 priorities and there was no way that we could reduce them to, you know, to four or five. I just had a different reaction. I went up to Dick at that same break and I said, Dick, I really don't know what the other functions are going to do, but effective today, this is how we're going to run sales and marketing, you know, kind of, you know, fill me up, let's go. And that was, you know, sort of my reaction to it, or even individual transformation that came as a result of learning this complete system.
Yeah, and what I love about it is just the elegant simplicity in it. You know, the focus you can derive from it. But you talk about it in the book. I mean, it really starts with having a pretty clear, you know, mission statement, and you give some of the different examples in the book, but tell us about that and sort of the art behind how you come up with, you know, a mission statement that can be that maybe the guiding light for the organization, and then things that are derived out of that.
Cool, absolutely. You know, when we start with this system, we focus initially a lot on inputs to the system, clear voice of customer, voice of employee, voice of shareholder inputs, and ensure that those are clear and understood by all. A voice of shareholder is a prescriptive input to the vision and the mission of the company, right? Because in the vision element, you're really looking at how you want to be perceived by the world in the future, 3 to 5 years out. Some people go out longer than that, but typically, it's 3 to 5 years out, and there are some prescriptive elements like revenue, margins, market share, whatever. But there's also an aspirational aspect, which is probably even more powerful, which is to imagine what the company could be in the future, right? And then to try to distill that down to a statement that's dramatically different than where you are today, that's concise, that's memorable, that's aspirational, and that can guide decisions and actions, right? And that's kind of the key part, is having that future state, that goal, this is where we're going, having everybody in the organization understand it, right? So it should be simple and memorable, and be able to line up their activities to support it and help the company realize it. In mission, it's more about the present tense and what we do today, for whom and how and why. And that's also critically important, right? To understand what business you're in, and what business you're not in. Helps you stick to your knitting, as we like to say. But it also, when it's well constructed, it informs a new employee on day one, you know, of the answers to those critical questions. We often hear, you know, in companies that have a well-deployed HPMS or high-performance management system, that that in companies absent that, it often takes 6 months to find the answers to those questions, what you do, for whom, and how, and that kind of thing. So yeah, mission and vision are where we start building out the system.
And can you give give an example of sort of the, you know, powerful vision statements that you've seen, and mission statements? And I don't know if you can have it at the top of your head, but if there's examples of poorly constructed vision and mission statements. But let's start with what, you know, what are the more powerful ones?
Well, I'd say one of my favorite business transformation stories in the last decade or so is Ford Motor Company under Alan Mulally. And his vision was simple. It was one Ford. And so I like that, right? Because it's very simple, it's very short, it's concise, it's memorable, but it also drove a tremendous number of decisions and actions in the company. Before Mulally, Ford was not one Ford. Ford was Ford China, Ford Canada, Ford America, Ford Europe, Ford Brazil, and they had Aston Martin, and they had Volvo, and they had Jaguar, and they had Range Rover. And so they were not one Ford. They were, you know, dozens of car companies. And Alan said, look, we've got to simplify our operation. We've got to seek and find the best subcompact globally, the best compact, the best small sedan, and on through the product line, and consolidate around common platforms and a common approach globally. And so by architecting a vision of one Ford, it really said all of that in two words. We're going to focus on the blue oval. One of the first things he did was asked his executives to stop driving the exotic foreign brands and drive Fords to work. And it was key in I think in leading that transformation. Another one that I really like, if you want a second one, was at EV3. In the peripheral vascular business, where their vision was to be the number one in the lower extremity, right? You know, there's a lot of places you can go in the vasculature of the body, right? And where you want it, and so identifying where we're going to be number one, or where we're going to win, I think is another powerful approach to a vision statement, saying that we're going to be the world leader or the number one or the best at something. Right. And so when EV3 claimed number one in lower extremity, and Stacy Insing Singh, who was president of the division at the time, put that on her success tree and shared it with some key customers, they responded and said, gee, we didn't know that your goal was to be number one in the lower extremity. We're having a lower extremity conference in a few months. Would you be interested in providing present being the keynote speaker? And just that little story of was kind of where they started the journey. They made a bold claim to be number one below the knee, primarily with their atherectomy products, but with other supportive products. That obviously guided a lot of decisions and actions within the company. But by using her success tree, she convinced others, even outside of the company, to be part of that journey towards that future state. And so both of those examples, and I could keep going with more, but they're very similar, right? Short, memorable, aspirational, and guide decisions and actions.
That's super helpful. And I don't know if it comes to mind, and maybe a specific one doesn't come to mind, but it sounds like where you can go wrong here with a vision statement is something that is you know, maybe too complicated or you know, not something everybody can grasp onto right away. Is that where you think people get in trouble with the vision?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, another really powerful one we did over 10 years ago was at Spectranetics in Colorado. You're probably familiar with that company. They were acquired by Philips a few years ago. Anyway, we were sitting at $150 million in revenue at the time, and we're in our, you know, the offsite session, building the tree, describing who we want to be in the, what company we want to be in the future. What's that? What is that future state? How would we describe it? We kept describing it as, look, we've got to double the revenue. We've got, you know, to get to that threshold level of, we need to go to from 150 to 300 million. Right. And we kept kind of, that was the prescriptive element. Remember when I said, when you kind of capture the voice of shareholder and their future state, kind of line up your vision with that. That's part of the exercise, and the 300 million was clearly an input along those lines. In the end, we Scott Drake was the CEO and continues to use HPMS today at ViewRay, where he's currently CEO. He said, "Let's just call it Mission 300." And so, at the top of their success tree and for their vision statement, it said Mission 300. And what that, again, very concise, we put it on a card. We all took a picture with this Mission 300 in front of us. And it said, we're going to be a $300 million company, right? Think of how brutally simple that is, but also think about the message it sent, you know, through the organization, knowing that, hey, you know, sales, we've got to double. Manufacturing, operations, we need to double. Every other aspect of the company needs to support that aspirational future state. And so, you know, guess what? They got to $285 million, and they sold the company to Philips for $2.2 billion. If Philips hadn't bought them, you know, at the time they did, they clearly would have exceeded the 300 mark. But you could argue, Jeff, if they hadn't put the stake in the ground at 300, made a claim to become that, they may or may not have achieved that, right? And so it's as simple in some cases as staking a claim, an aggressive claim, an audacious claim that you may or may not have a right to claim, and then defending that claim and then realizing that claim.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think something people get often mixed up is sort of vision and mission statement. So what's an example of a mission statement then and what you try to do with that?
Well, again, you know, a mission statement is a bit shorter. I'm sorry, it's a bit longer than a vision statement. It's sometimes more than one sentence, but it's a bit, you know, it's a bit more pedestrian around, you know, what we do today, for whom, and kind of, you know, why we do it. I'll read our mission statement as an example, so I don't share anything proprietary here. But our mission at Haffey & Company is that we gather key customer, employee, and shareholder inputs to develop and continually improve our client strategy. We ensure breakthrough results through quality practices and a proven management system. And so that answers, you know, kind of what we do, for whom, and a bit of the how. No rocket science there, Jeff. And when we go through that exercise.
And what I, you know, what I like about this is that, you know, out of those two come these vital few initiatives. And, you know, so often in our companies, and I'm sure you see this time and again, the companies are doing so many different things. And like you referenced it earlier, where it's just, you know, there's even not a sense that you could boil that things down to a handful of initiatives. But talk about that and talk about the importance of sort of narrowing your focus to that vital few set of, you know, I guess not activities, but vital few initiatives.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, this is really kind of the main course is the vital few, right? That is the, your strategy. You know, what are the most important things, you know, relative to everything else? And back to Pareto, the theory there, the management theory is that your strategy or your one-page strategy represents the 20% of the strategic items that are going to close 80% of the strategic gap. It's not an attempt, you know, to put 100% of the things that you're doing, especially the things that you're doing to keep the lights on, and but the things that are transformational. So when I apply a Pareto, going after the 20% of the items, I'm able to focus on breakthroughs. And the key here, key word here is breakthrough, right? If I want incremental improvement, I can incrementally improve 20 things at a time, right? And if I incrementally improve 20 things at a time, I'm incrementally improving my business results, right? I'm just kind of slowly moving the business, perhaps forward, perhaps treading water, who knows? But the goal of leadership is to take the company to different to new places, to discreetly different places, right? And in order to do that, you need breakthroughs, breakthroughs in technology, breakthroughs in service, breakthroughs in process, right? And so, and the only way to get breakthroughs is with focus. So it all kind of starts with Pareto theory, focus, and then gets you into breakthrough. And that's really the thinking behind each one of the vital few that you put on your success tree, is that you're not looking for incremental on any of these. You're looking for discrete step function change that when executed with excellence is going to put you in a new place as a company. And that, you know, back to the summit story, that's what we did. We picked a few things at a time. They were breakthrough in nature. They were leaps. They weren't baby steps. And, you know, in 3 years, we had a completely different company, a company that was indistinguishable from the one, you know, that we started at. And it was done through that sort of closed loop, iterative focus on a few things, few boulders, crush those boulders, pick up a couple more, crush those a couple more. And it wasn't about, you know, the annual operating plan, or, you know, it was more about performance. When you get this done, go pick something up out of the bin, right? And when you get that one done, go pick something. And so it was more based on performance and execution and actual results than it was on some sort of artificial plan cycle or things like that. And by the way, that's where I think a lot of the waste, you know, the lens on waste comes in, right? Is that, you know, if you see a company that spends 8 months on an annual operating plan, boy, what a waste of time, you know, because after that 8 month effort, then, you know, 2 weeks into the year, that 8 month event is obsolete. Right. And yeah. So, yes, it's important to have a budget. I'm not saying you don't run without a budget. It's just, where is it in the priority of things, right? In too many cases, you know, a CFO will say, we need this and we need it by that. And then, so, you know, another leader will say they need something else in a certain time. And pretty soon you're just busy. Everybody's busy. There's a ton of activity. There's a lack of alignment. And you're not moving the company forward because you're not focused on the big steps that are going to get you there.
Yeah, that, it just makes so much sense. And, you know, another thing I really like about this is it really is a living organism, right? When you create this and you're constantly feeding it with the voice of customer, voice of employee, voice of shareholders. So can you talk about that, how that gets infused into all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when Xerox deployed this now more than two decades ago, one of the cornerstones was surveying 55,000 customers a month. And so it was an event. It was an ongoing process. You see that best practice today in, you know, places like Ritz-Carlton or Delta Airlines, whatever, that it's not an event. Oh, let's do a customer survey. It's a continual process of capturing the voice of your customer and understanding, you know, where you can improve. And importantly, in measuring the quality of your products and services in the voice of the customer, that simple concept is what, you know, what led Toyota to be number one in automobiles. And when companies really embrace that concept, it can be breakthrough nature. But the gap, if we think about it from a gap standpoint, is, you know, where is your customer willingness to recommend or net promoter score, same thing today, current state, future state is 100% willing to recommend. And then if we parameter the gap, ideally based on data from the voice of customer, you know, what are the one or two most important things that we can do as a company to close that gap? You know, is it product? Is it service? Is it both? Or is it something else? Right. And not trying to translate it into something that's more convenient once it comes inside the company. There's a story in the book about intralays and the speed of the laser. When we launched the laser, it was at 10 kilohertz, and then we went to 15, and then we went to 30, and R&D kind of thought they were done, but the customer didn't, right? The customer wasn't satisfied at 30. And so we used that voice of customer to drive the program to 60 kilohertz. And once we got to that level, we broke through with the customer because it really started to meet their expectations, you know, for speed. And so, you know, many companies will say, okay, well, you know, we've done pretty well. We tripled the speed since launch from 10 to 30. Let's go on to something else, right? At Intralase, we were more disciplined than that. We said, we were diligent about capturing voice of the customer, analyzing it, parading it, and saying whatever the number one thing is, that's what we're going to, you know, continue to go after. And even after we tripled the speed, it was still speed, and so we had to double it again, despite, you know, a lot of internal resistance to that and a lot of internal sort of desire to go on to other projects within the pipeline.
Yeah, and you know, listening to the customer is difficult enough for many companies, and the surprising number who don't do that well. But then listening to the employees, and what I like what you say in the book is, you know, your employees are the ones that are, you know, spending the vast majority of their life in that company, right, with that product, and are incredible, you know, feedback loops to the company, but something that's not always taken advantage of. So talk about that.
It's a very powerful but yet simple concept. Again, when I met this system, I don't think I'd ever completed an employee survey or even thought about deploying one, right? You know, it was more of like a Bill Belichick, just do your job type of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But it really opened my eyes to a different way of managing culture or the importance of culture, right? We have in our one page document, we have a set of values that shape culture. And then we have a whole branch on the success tree that has the same gap, willingness to recommend gap that we have in the customer branch, same Pareto approach of saying, you know, let's measure and continually improve employee willingness to recommend Summit as a place of work, right? And so we use the same analysis, the same discipline to say, let's measure and continually improve employee engagement, right, with data and with voice of employee, not interpreting it again, taking it, solving employee problems, showing the employees that you're listening and responding, and that you take their satisfaction just as seriously as you take any other outcome, financial or customer. In fact, when it gets to theory, and this is, you know, sort of maybe back to the comment about management science, you either believe or you don't believe that motivated employees lead to satisfied customers that lead to healthier financials, right? That's a theoretical statement. A plus B equals C, right? Or leads to C. And if you don't believe that, you manage results in your shareholder branch, you know, sell more lasers or sell more procedures or whatever it is, right? Instead of saying, gee, you know, my role as a leader is culture and employee engagement, and I need to spend a lot of time there, and customer, what we can do to improve that experience, and then about a third of my time on results, right? And before learning this system, in the company I was in previously, Mentor, was all about results, was all about the shareholder. We paid lip service to the customer and had zero employee interest in the employee, right? And so this was liberating from that standpoint of saying, yeah, 67% of the real estate on our one-page strategic plan is about these leading indicators of customer employee willingness to recommend us in the future. How liberating, right? To know that that's where I should be spending two-thirds of my time with people and with customers, and about a third on ensuring, you know, that the results are going to meet shareholder expectations.
Thanks for tuning in to this podcast. If you enjoy these types of conversations and perspectives, then we, as the podcast producer, encourage you to check out the related MedTech MVP conference at medtechconference.com. For 10% off the conference registration, please use the discount code podcast1.
Yeah, and that's probably a good segue then into the voice of the shareholder, which sounds like was overemphasized at Mentor. But how do you then, tell us about voice of shareholder and that, how that should be infused back into the business?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical, right? Because we look at, again, from a quality standpoint, it's about stakeholder satisfaction. That is the definition of quality. When I deliver something to you as a stakeholder that meets your requirements or exceeds your requirements, that's quality. And so the idea is, how do we do that for all our stakeholders? We start with customer, employee, shareholder. When Ford did this, they had their suppliers, their dealers, the community, even the union, along with their employees, customers, and shareholders. So it's a minimum of three, and sometimes more than that. But in terms of the shareholder in particular, and most of our engagement, I should take a step back. Most of our engagements are with newly appointed CEOs, and so we're helping that CEO understand that voice of their shareholder through board interviews. If it's a public company, we interview folks in the market as it relates to their views on the stock. And there are a couple of things that come through that exercise. One is alignment, right? When we ask about priorities, and one board member saying it's EBIT and the other says it's growth, that's a challenge, right? For the new team, they've got to get alignment at the board level on what the priorities are. And so that's one of the outputs of that exercise, is to say, hey, this is what we heard. Now, how can we get aligned and build that into a working voice of shareholder document that gets redistributed to the board? The board says, yep, that fairly represents our voice as representative of the shareholder. And then that becomes an input, a working input, to, you know, for the company to build out its priorities at the highest level and throughout the organization, right? So you're trying to first nail that voice, consolidate, make sure it's that everybody's aligned on what the shareholder, you know, what would delight the shareholder in the future, how they see the current challenges and opportunities, getting that alignment, and then sharing that through the company so that not only at the highest levels you build the tree, but everywhere in the organization, employees and teams understand what they need to do to satisfy that critical stakeholder. And so, you know, it sounds simple. I think it is. It's simple is not the same as easy, as you can imagine, with an exercise like that. But it, when done well, it's incredibly powerful, and it can also be somewhat liberating for the directors themselves, because you know, I've been on three boards and on one now, and you know, typical board meeting, you might have the floor for 2 minutes with a question, right, and then you go on. Very rarely are you interviewed for an hour or so on your views of the company, and that with the same structured approach that every other member's interviewed, and then that comes back. And oftentimes I'll hear, "Gee, this is great. I don't usually get this much time to share my thoughts on the company." There's not a lot of analysis and rocket science there. It's more of just having process and doing it.
Yeah, a complexity I could imagine, but I wonder if this happens is where, you know, the voice of customer, voice of employee, and voice of shareholder don't necessarily feed in together. There's maybe conflict there. Are there situations where you're having to prioritize one or the other? And well, how does that work?
That's what comes out we call it the sausage making, right? when you're making these decisions and you're putting them on, you know, a one page document, you're not going to satisfy everybody, right? Some people are probably going to be dissatisfied because their initiative or their area didn't make the cut. But the key is leaving that session with everybody in full support of the tree. And so in the case of before where I talked about EBIT and growth, if the company and as a whole with support from the board says it's about growth, then it's going to be about growth, right? Until some other future iteration where it probably does become more about profitability. But you can't pursue both, right? In fact, you can't get a breakthrough in growth and a breakthrough in bottom line, most likely, with the same, you know, sort of focus. So, a lot of that comes out in the wash. The other comfort, you know, is that with the closed loop approach, is that if you're, you know, if EBIT doesn't make the cut in a given cycle, or some other element of the strategy doesn't make the cut, and it's important, it'll get picked up in a successive, you know, cycle of improvement. And so, I don't know if that answers your question clearly enough, but yeah, there's always, yeah, some tension, and sausage baking. And our mantra is that it's expected, and so long as you like the way it tastes at the end, it's okay if it's a little ugly as we go through it.
Yeah, maybe tell me what you think about this. I mean, my simplistic way of thinking about it is a maniacal focus on the customer should yield results which satisfy the shareholder. I mean, to a certain extent, I suppose, profitability might be, you might go so far to satisfy the customer that you fail to become profitable. But I would think that, you know, the voice of the customer would be, I would naturally think the voice of the customer should be prioritized. But what do you think about that?
That it should naturally be prioritized.
Yeah, maybe even above the voice of the employee or voice of those two voices, employee and shareholder, are unimportant.
But it's an interesting one. I think customers at the top of the hierarchy there, but we have a lot of clients that believe it's the employee, or they like to refer to the employee as the teammate, and they build their success tree with the teammate at the top, and then they go to the customer and they go to shareholder. But yeah, I guess if I had to choose between one or the other, I would say really understanding the voice of your customer intimately and what you absolutely need to do to improve their satisfaction is probably more important or more challenging to do right than to understand what you need to do to improve the employee experience.
Something you talk about in the book, which I find really critical within our companies, is the importance of a number two who can really operationalize a lot of this. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's an elite TED video that I reference in that section of the book as well. But if you have a minute, you should I'd take a look at it. But yeah, the number two, number three, number four, when it comes to a transformation, when it comes to the adoption of a management system like this, are more important than the number one. It's clear that when we go into a company, it's clear that number one wants it, and that's why we're there in the first place. And we almost exclusively come in with the CEO, and even there almost exclusively newly appointed CEO, right? And so there's a difference between the number two and number three saying, "Hey Joe, yeah, that's great. We're gonna implement a high performance management system," and they're in it sort of 90% or 100%, and so on. In those cases, in our experience, adoption is slow by the rest of the organization. It's especially slow and debilitating if number two is at 80% in or less, and they may be undermining the system or they may be skeptical of its value and that kind of thing. On the other hand, when the number two is 110% in, and the number three and number four, when that you're now building a lead, a guiding a coalition of change agents who are going to take it forward and take it to the new, to kind of the next level. Jeff, when I look back on my career, I was probably a better number two than I was a number one. And I would say that characterized sort of my approach to the system. Take Stacy and Sing Sing too, the example I gave earlier, where she, where she took her tree outside the building and started sharing it with customers. She was signaling to Bob Palmisano at EV3 at the time, "Bob, okay, you told us we're doing this. Watch me go. Watch how far I can take this. Watch how far I can jump with this." And that really drove, I think, a lot of the success and traction that EV3 was able to develop through HPMS.
Yeah, and then having having her in Stacy's example, having her people really accept that as the gospel, and so I mean you can see the sort of multiplier effect this has as people really grasp onto this and see what a powerful tool it can be. It raises the question also, and I love how you reference Nick Saban in the book, the Alabama head coach. And the importance of systems, and we hear it here in New England, certainly with Bill Belichick. It seems to be a raging debate. Is it the Belichick way, Patriot way, or is it players like Tom Brady that have made the difference? And I'm curious what you think. Is it the system or is it the people? I mean, the reality, probably both, but tell me about that distinction, the system versus maybe A players.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to that, right? I think you need A players on the field in the NFL and in your leadership team. There can't be any compromise. Those have to be top 1% players. The challenge, though, is as you build an organization, you start to scale the organization to hundreds of people. It's naive to think that you're going to recruit top 1% or even top 3% as you scale an organization. Scale is going to leave you with normal distribution, right? Your organization is going to sort of normally distribute around average, maybe skewed a little bit above average, but generally speaking, you're going to run an organization that's 80% full of average people. And those are the people that are touching your customers. Those are the people that are manufacturing your products. The challenge there is, how do you get great results out of good people? And I think there is where process comes in. If you look at Ritz-Carlton, they don't necessarily hire different types of people than Marriott. They get better results through better process. And then back to, Belichick and Saban. One of my favorites with Saban was early in his tenure at Alabama, when somebody asked about their record, their wins and losses. Saban commented that he wasn't sure what their record was, that in fact he didn't look backwards at, what they won or lost yesterday. Sort of like a good manager would say, I don't look backwards at what I sold yesterday and how much profit I made. I've looked forward to how we can improve, right? And his process included benchmarking. They benchmarked everything in their offense and their defense and their special teams, pouring over data to pinpoint the specific areas where they could improve. I think the specific example with Saban is that, they were ranked number one in the country. Their defense was ranked number one. Their offense was ranked number one. Their special teams were ranked number one. But once you started to drill down into the offense, in this one story I read, that offense was number three in yards after the catch. And so what do you think Saban worked on in practice that week? He worked on, let's improve our yards after the catch, right? And so that's a sort of an analytical way of looking at things, but it's also causal, right? It's saying, I'm not saying let's win more games, right? Because that's obvious. I'm saying let's work on the critical things that we need to work on so that the output is that we'll win more games. And then finally on Saban is, very strong on culture and very strong on appearance. When he got to Alabama, the players were, they had their pants down and underwear out the back and all that. And he said right from day one, he said, look, if you're going to play here in Alabama, I expect your shirt to tuck in. I don't expect to see anybody's underwear, and I'd like you to wear a belt. And with that simple statement, he set the tone. We're gonna dress like pros, and we're gonna play like pros, and and that's the way we're gonna do things around here.
Yeah, and in our dialogue leading up to this, you gave me another example that resonated with me. I think it was one of the people in your organization or that you were consulting with, and maybe tell that story, the effect of changing their appearance had on.
Yeah. Okay. That was a fun one. I was running a company, a venture-backed company in med device, and my head of quality regulatory would come to work in sweatpants and a t-shirt and maybe a fleece vest, that kind of thing. And it didn't offend me personally, but I actually had some people comment about it to me, and so I used that as an opportunity in a staff meeting, at the end of a staff meeting, to say that, I also think we could improve our appearance around here. And this particular VP was, you know, he was an attorney and he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. And he said, so what you're telling me, Bernie, is the way you look is important to how you perform. And I said, well, I'll call him Bill. I said, Bill, let's just do a thought experiment together. And we were in Mansfield, Massachusetts. We were a few miles away from Foxborough. And I said, let's do a thought experiment where we take the next eight Patriots. They had eight home games that year. Four of the home games, they're going to wear their NFL uniforms, New England Patriots uniforms. And the other four arm of this study, they're going to wear Mansfield High School uniforms. And I said, you know, Bill, in which arm, group do you think they're setting themselves up to be more successful? He said, I got your point. He came in the next day in khakis and a button-down shirt. And so my concern was that FDA could walk in any day and hit me point, and I wouldn't want to show anything but professionalism to an agency like that. But it also kind of set the tone internally that that we were playing as bros.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Interesting. So maybe as we, you know, think about a situation, because you have a nice section of the book that talks about, you know, failure modes or pitfalls to this. When, you know, where doesn't this work, and or what are the challenges you sometimes run into in making this, you know, the tool that really can be as powerful as it should be?
Yeah, well, we touched on one of them already, and that's when number two is not in at 110%. That's a failure mode. Let's see. Another is when I'm brought in. I was brought in by a board of directors to a company and to a reluctant CEO, and you know, so he didn't bring me. He didn't believe in it a priority. He was told to do it. And that was a failure, right? And because he kind of head nod and then I'd leave and then they'd go back to doing whatever it was they were doing before. And so I've avoided those, situations where with that kind of a dynamic. And then thirdly, I would say another one is, we do a fair amount of work in larger corporations. And we'll take a division or an operating unit. In some companies, you know, like Medtronic, that all pivot around a common mission, and they've been using this framework for quite a while. It works out great. In other cases, though, you know, the corporate folks present too many competing themes. Not only in terms of things like purpose and vision and mission and values, but in terms of problem solving. You know, HPMS is a very simple sort of four-step closed loop plan, do, check, act type problem solving process that's approachable, that's proven over decades. And it's critical to the system. But we find that, you know, larger corporations will say, yeah, we get that, but we want to use DMAIC or we want to use FX16 or some other thing. And then, so now the employees are like, yeah, I want to do structured problem solving, but am I taking this one or that one? And so that's a failure mode for us, is when we're in a situation where there's just, you know, simply too many competing themes or processes that the value or the power of HPMS kind of gets choked out.
Yeah. And I can see that. I mean, I can see it bigger companies where, you know, you do have consultants coming in and you have change management, you have, you know, lots of different attempts over the years. Do you find that in situations you've been involved in that they're kind of just weary of all the different things that have been tried?
Oh yeah.
And what is
yeah, there's no question.
Yeah, how do you get them over the hump with this
I'd say my biggest asset in all engagements is that I spent a majority of my career as an operating executive, not as a consultant. Mm-hmm. I challenge a McKinsey guy to say that, or they can't, because they've spent a majority of their lives as consultants. And in that same vein, I think I'd sell that right away. You know, I've spent more time in your shoes on your side of this conference room than up here, right? And I think that comes through. I think that that authenticity of my experience, comes through. And then another thing that we do, and it's very, very different than, you know, McKinsey or Boston or many of these others, is we look to hand the system off to the management team. You know, we help build it. We work on the inputs. We built the first version. We get it moving. We get the stoplight reporting going. We help with, you know, we facilitate where necessary. But our whole goal is to hand this thing back off to the company and for them to own it and continually improve it, you know, from there. So we're not in, you know, we're not in for, you know, to put our hooks into an organization for years, right? The way some of the aforementioned might. And likewise, we're not looking to get in and then expand our billing and go into other areas of the business. We're looking to get in, add a tremendous amount of value acutely over a relatively short period of time, and move on and do that at the next place. And so I think when people hear, well, this isn't another, you know, McKinsey 200 line transformation approach. This is, you know, these are practical operating people that are here, you know, to help us. I think we get over that flavor of the week. And then clearly, again, you know, we come in with the CEO. And so the hope is that most savvy employees get that. Gee, you know, CEO thinks this is important. I think I should pay attention and do everything I can to adopt it.
Yeah. So I wonder, just as we wrap up here, I wonder if, and you've mentioned some of the companies which you've worked with, and you've worked with so many companies now, but is there another one that really stands out in your experience as really transforming themselves with HPMS? And could you just maybe describe what happened there?
Yeah. Well, let's see. We touched on Summit. We touched on Intralase. We touched on Spectranetics, EV3. I could go to LensX as another example. It was about $27 million invested for roughly $750 million sale. And what I like probably the most about that one is that I didn't have anything to do with it. It was the founder of Intralase, Ron Kurtz, Eric Weinberg, and Tibor Uhaus, who started LensX immediately after Intralase. And the first thing that they did in their first meeting was to build out a success tree. And they even took a picture and they sent it to me. And I can't tell you how that warmed my heart to see, you know, the smart, you know, some of the smartest people I know starting a business, having, you know, and two of those three were skeptics of HPMS when we first implemented it at Intralase. But to see these smart folks sit down, start a company, and reflexively build a success tree that reflected, you know, their priorities. I did end up helping with some employee survey work there, but
but really had, had very little to do with it as an individual, consultant. And so cases like that where, where executives who may have been skeptical go through it, learn it, and then just go back to it over and over again. Those are always rewarding stories. And so that's another one that that kind of comes to mind in a somewhat different context.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. Well, Bernie, this has been awesome. I mean, I can't tell you how appreciative I am. We've had the chance to use you at one of the companies where I was on the board, and I can see the effect of everything you talk about in the book, sort of coursing through the company's culture now, and how much that's had an impact on what they're doing and how they're doing it, and how they really continue to inform their business and business decisions. So it's an incredibly powerful tool. I really recommend everybody listening to go out and read the book, because it is a very digestible, elegantly simple way of looking at these, how to go about transforming your business. Bernie, you can get it on Amazon. Is that right?
That's right. Yep. Amazon or Barnes and Noble.
Yep.
Just about anywhere you can buy books online. The publisher is Simon & Schuster. I think it's on their website as well. And if you like it, please post a review and reach out if you'd like to learn more about how to implement it at your organization. Jeff, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Bernie. And it was a great discussion, and love seeing all the impact it's had at the various companies. So great speaking, and thanks for joining us.